All right. Yeah, hello. Welcome to my talk. My name is Andre. I work at Arm in Cambridge. And this is not a presentation about Arm. I'm just using basically Arm device as an example. So the whole point of this is that recently, so I'm maintaining the Allwinner port in U-Boot. And recently I figured that there's a lot of people that do a lot of work, but not upstream. So they work and have patches and have stuff working, and they come on IRC and ask questions and get them answered and say, great, it works, and then vanish. So that's not ideal. And this presentation is more to motivate people to really upstream their stuff, because that's needed. So what the result of this is that support for certain ARM boards, it's patchy. Some boards are well supported. This is basically typically the boards that the maintainers physically have and can do stuff in testing. But other boards that are very similar, as we just learned from the device tree talk, it's basically just the device tree that's the difference. And you can copy stuff from boards. Sometimes they use the same RTC, or just use a different voltage control or whatever. So you can copy stuff, and it's not complicated. But if you look in mainline, then you find some boards well supported, others not, and that's not really needed. The solution is there that you contribute to mainline projects by contributing in a wider sense of doing testing, doing reviewing, and sending patches eventually. And I also will talk a bit about email contribution process, since what I hear, this is what a lot of even especially younger people kind of dissent and say, yeah, it's email. We don't know how to send patches by email. We use GitHub, GitLab, click here, click there. It's somewhat different, but it's not complicated. I mean, it's email, right? You can write an email. All right, so what's the problem? So some ports have some level of upstream support. Many boards lack certain features that other boards have in the same, but using the same SOC sometimes, so it's not really necessary. Another problem we see is that many boards are supported by, I call them downstream projects. The changes are public somewhere. You can find patches somewhere, but they are not in the mainline repositories. And that unfortunately includes popular open source projects like Buildroot, Yocto, and Armbian. They all have facilities to collect patches that are not mainlined and then maintain them in their own patch repository, so patches of patches, basically, and they apply them on some mainline thing. So if you manage to get your board described or the changes for your board described there, then it works if you use Armbian, Yocto, Buildroot. But then, interestingly, the final step is missing, that those patches should be just pushed into the original repository. Another problem is that the social network structure of GitHub, GitLab, or whatever, and all these communities, they create some kind of shadow bubble, I would say. So where people say, yeah, I'm working in this community, and I got this board supported, it works with mainline, they say, because it's using a mainline kernel as a base, but actually it's not properly supported in mainline. And especially if you do real embedded devices, so you have a specific use case and you create an image for that device, then you don't strictly depend on real mainlining, because you can always put your own patches on top and ship that with the device. But again, it's not necessary. So what can you do? There are proper mainline projects which build a foundation of every Linux system that you see. That's the Linux kernel, obviously. That's U-Boot, Barebox, or whatever, other bootloaders. Trusted firmware for most 64-bit systems, for most 64-bit ARM systems, or OpenSPI for RISC-V systems. The various SCP firmware projects, so that is the firmware for management controllers that are not the main controller, but either on the sock or on the board. And you can do contributing in several ways. So the first somewhat easy thing is that people kind of take it granted sometimes or find it too easy and just don't talk about it. So it's test on your device. So there are, for instance, for All Winner in U-Boot, we have 161 boards supported. They use selection of, let's say, 10 different socks. So as you can imagine, no one can have all those 161 devices, and no one wants those devices. So it's good that several people out there had several boards. So what would be already helpful if you have some obscure board or even some non-obscure board, and just test it. Just take whatever you have and test, especially if you see a patch supporting something, just try to use that patch and test it on your board and report back to the mainline. So not only, I mean, especially if you see that something's wrong, then yes, please definitely report back. But also if it works, it would be great to hear that someone else has tested it. That gives you, A, that gives you some visibility and you start contributing. But it also helps the maintainer to see, oh, great, it's not only the author that wrote the patch that confirms that it's testing, someone else has tested it. So it gives them some confidence that, yes, this is the right thing and that it works. Also, please test early RC releases. I often see people waiting until some kernel release or some U-Boot and Bearbox release and then testing and then saying, it doesn't work. And I say, great, I would have loved to hear this 8 weeks ago and then I could have fixed that. But so now don't use stable kernels. Stable kernels are for distributions, not for you. So you, many people, they're scared of early releases, but actually this is what we need. We need all the people out there, the crowd, to test the stuff on early stuff. That's why we have these release candidates, so that people can, we can spot stuff early and fix it so that the release is actually stable and works. You should start as early as possible, RC1, RC2. If you have RC1, it's not always a good choice. If you don't know what you're doing, wait for RC2. RC2 is tomorrow, I think. Yeah, for the kernel, it's tomorrow, so you wait till then. As I say, if you say any fixes or something, report it back, please, to the list. Also, what I see sometimes, then people say, oh, that doesn't work on mainline, but they start bisecting and going back into different releases and say, oh, I found a version that works. I will use that, thanks. And then I gun, right? And say, wait, please don't run away. We need to fix this mainline because today's RC is next year stable, right? So if you don't fix it now, then it will never be fixed, basically, and you can't always stick to the old releases. So things need to be fixed upstream. And even if you don't have a specific patch, you could just, it would be surprising for you how often things are actually broken and no one notices, especially if you have multiple boards and multiple versions. So if you just take the current mainline of each repository for the kernel or U-boot or whatever and test it on your device, that would be already helpful. So some people have a special setup. They have, I don't know, more flaky power supply, or they use GPIO on the pins or whatever, and suddenly, so for instance, sometimes broken that UART with hardware flow control, or USB works, but USB OTG doesn't work for some reason, and sometimes just some simple thing missing. So testing, that is the rather easy thing. The order of putting review just after testing and before contribution is a bit debatable, because reviews are actually, if you do it properly, they are sometimes harder than writing patches. But you need to start somewhere. So you can do easy stuff. So try to review patches that you see. You can do, what I do is you can, it's something that requires a lot of experience to do properly. But you can start with some schematic things. So what I often try is verify the commit message and patch match. So a good example is this below. I just was sent around last week, I think. It says already in a subject, replace all spy chip select and spy CGPIOD references with function calls. So if you read the commit message and read one part of the patch, you will see, oh, it's kind of schematic change. Everything that is spy chip select is now actually a callback. So it's calling a function instead of using the variable. So what you can do is you just go ahead and verify that, A, this is really what the patch is doing, and there's nothing else sneaked in, and B, that it's, for instance, covers all spy chip selects. So you can do this with some Unix command line magic, which I like to do. It's just grabbing around and then trying, for instance, you could try to replay the patch. So say, oh, if I would need to write a patch, I would probably use SED or something, or some automated thing to replace that. And then you can compare that what you came up with is basically matching. Another thing I like to do is I copy the patch into two files, call one before, one after, and remove every plus from the before one and remove every minus from the after one, so that you have basically the before and after things. And then you try to do the conversion, like replacing, that's kind of schematic replacing, in the before and see that you end up with after. So, yeah, you can try to use automation tools to verify. Another good example that you can do is code moves. So sometimes often you see no functional change intended, it just moves the code around. And then I actually try to see, oh, the part that has been deleted and has been added is actually the same. Sometimes it's not, because you need to adjust to, it's one level of intention deeper or something, or a variable has been renamed. But you can then figure out what's it doing. Also, other things, if you see advisory patch which says the address of the SPI device is 0x51, then you look up in the datasheet and look up if it's really 51. Or very grateful example is the memory map. So it's very easy to look up in the memory map of a TRM to see, oh, at which address is this device, and verify that those bits match. So that's relatively straightforward things that you can do and that provide value. But if you then have done this and try to avoid to send just reviewed by, the problem is that if the maintainer doesn't know you, he doesn't know what you are doing, how legible you are in terms of reviewing, how experienced and what you did and if that's good or not. So sometimes if there's an unknown person sending just an empty reviewed by, I don't really know what to take from it. Is it good? Is that person reliable? Did he do the right thing? Or did he just want to do his colleague a favor because he wrote the patch or something? So what you can do is you just, instead of just writing reviewed by, you say what you did. So basically you say, oh, I copied this all over and tried this, or I looked this up and compared this against the manual and this manual. And actually you will be surprised. Sometimes often you find things that are not quite right. And sometimes things are not quite right for a reason. For instance, if you do code moves, there's some change. And then what you can do is you can ask questions. Shouldn't it be like this, for instance? And that tells the maintainer, oh yeah, this person actually looked at the code. And then we'll say, yeah, it should be because of that and that. And most maintainers are then happy that people actually read the code. And that gives you some credibility as a reviewer. And then people understand, okay, that's actually, if that's the only thing you found and you did this level of detail in your review, then your review is really good. Also avoid blanket review. That's often I see from companies, they send out a patch and already have a reviewed by tag from a colleague in there. And I understand that this has been an internal review process, but it's not really good if you do that publicly. The better way is you send it out, and then your colleague goes on the mailing list and replies explicitly from his email and says reviewed by. So again, hopefully again with some rationale, some support. Also, please avoid reviewed by for the whole series. So I've seen reviewed by for 25 patches sent 15 minutes after the series has been sent out. That tells me, well, you can't review 25 patches for real in 15 minutes. So there must be something fishy. I don't know. I mean, in this case, I could guess, yeah, maybe the guy has seen the series before, but it's... Yeah, then please write this at least in there. So I've seen this, or I have been co-developing, and we have been reviewing this internally before or something. Yeah. Okay. One thing which I found very interesting and helpful, and which many people don't know, is that you can upstream other people's patches. That is totally legit, and you can do this, and that's encouraged. So you find, as I said before, there are some those secondary projects which collect patches, and you can actually take those patches and upstream them. Or you pick up patches that have been on a mailing list a while ago, and then suddenly the people went away for whatever reason, didn't finish the upstreaming. You can continue doing this. One important thing is you need the authors signed off by for this. If the patch has been sent to the mailing list, that's usually the case. I often find that in for instance, an Ambien patch repository, there's the sign off by missing. So you would need to contact the author and ask for permission, which is customary anyway. It's nice to just ask the author, do you mind if I upstream your patches? Often they're happy that you do the work for them, basically, because it's a long-term process. Sometimes people, because circumstances change, they change company and are working for a competitor, they can't really upstream anymore, or they just lost interest in this, or their family happened, or whatever. So it's there are multiple reasons. When you send a patch, you can, even if you don't change it, or if you change it regardless, you need to keep the sign off by and the authorship in the patch. You do this with this git command if you apply the patch manually. And you need to add your own sign off by, even if you didn't change a bit in the patch, because sign off by doesn't mean you wrote it. Sign off by means you got it in legitimate ways and you are allowed to contribute this. So it's more a legal thing, that's why it's signed off. It would be good if you test it before you send it out. Again, it comes back to the testing part, because people suspect that the author or sender of the patch actually tests their stuff before sending them out. Also, rebasing, of course. I mean, the patch is typically a bit old then. Now, the nasty part is that people will address you with comments and any kind of requests that can be sometimes a bit... So sometimes people write, why did you write it this way? That's the nice part of putting the questions. Sometimes they say, this is wrong. And then it's like, oh my goodness, you sometimes feel offended. So yeah, it's not, I think for new people, it's actually better than the common sense of, oh, the kernel mailing list is a hostile place and everyone shouts at each other. That is mostly the case for if two engaged people meet each other, or if people should know better and don't do the right thing, then there's some shouting happening. But if it's clear that you are a new guy, and then people are friendly and happy, because maintainers are always looking for contributors, especially reviewers and testers. So and if you pick up some other people's work, then it's always good. But be ready to answer questions on behalf of the author. If you are lucky, the author chimes in. Sometimes it's not, your offer's not available anymore. And also what's important, and it's really hard, and I often fail in this, is stay with that and send updates and set, yeah, not just say, okay, I send it out and now it's good and will be merged, typically not. So I typically need 7 versions for stuff that I send out before it's actually merged. Don't send up, if you're used to Garrett or whatever, where you basically send in rapid succession fixes. So at work, the colleagues do that. I've seen 5 versions in 2 hours. That's not what you do on a mailing list. You can get annoy people really quickly. So typically, I mean, if it's an easy fix and nothing else, then yeah, I could send it out in 2 days. Typically, it's good to wait a week to give people time to review that and wait for more comments. It depends on the system. Yeah, so this is an example which I did. I found this patch on a list, and I thought, oh, that's interesting because I need this for some device of mine. So I just took the patch from. So I asked him first, and he says, oh yeah, I'm busy with uni. I can't do anything in the next 4 weeks. And I said, it would be a shame because we missed the merge panel. So do you mind if I just send? There were some comments on the patches and some simple things. Do you mind if I just take over and do this? So what's interesting that this is how the patch looks like. The part with the from is not in the email header, that's actually in the email body. And this is for Git to take this guy as the actual author. So this is if you send some on behalf of someone else, you see this from line. Also, if you misconfigure your Git send email, and then you see this as well. Or if you send from Gmail and actually have patch authors on your company address or whatever, whenever this is not matching. So I just copied this stuff and I added my send off by, as you can see. And sometimes if you changed something, then it's nice to put there in square brackets what you actually changed, just for so that people can see, oh, this is what he did. The downside of sending the patches is that the original author gets the credit in Git, right? So if you look for git log minus minus author, whatever, you will find the original person. But chances are that there are some that the replies from the maintainer require you to rewrite something, and then you more often than not actually get your own patch in as part of this series. And also you're still in the file because of your send off by. So you leave some trace, and it makes the maintainer will see your name and recognize that. For contributing, there are really low-hanging fruits. I mentioned this before. So we have different boards with the same SOC, and they just don't match up in a feature set because nobody cared for original board. That's where you come in because you care and you send. So you can just compare the device trees. Also, what's sometimes documentation gets quickly outdated, so sometimes comments don't match anymore stuff. So you can do that. This is one low-hanging fruit I sent 2 weeks ago. There was someone came on IRC and asked for a specific board why it's so slow, and we figured, oh yeah, they just forgot to add the OPP table, so that's the frequency scaling table. So it was running at a fixed frequency, which was set by U-boot at boot time. And it was a safe frequency. We know that works with the default voltage. In this case, 860 megahertz. The chip can do 1.2, right? So all of the time, and this board was in, it's actually, I upstreamed the original device tree like 5 years ago. And then DVFS came later and nobody cared. So I thought, okay, let's do this. So it's a one-line change. As you can see there in the device tree, actually. So I just include the generic OPP table, operation performance points table, which tells Linux, oh, actually, there are more frequencies. If you can upgrade the voltage, then you can run it at a higher frequency. And that is pretty generic, but requires testing. So if the cooling or the board layout is not good, then you might not reach all the frequencies that the SOC can do. It's rare, but sometimes, so that's why we don't blanketly include the OPP tables on every board. We want to see something. And this is where you come in, and if you see, hey, this is what I did, oh, my board, actually, you know, it's 50% faster with a one-line patch. Like, imagine that in a company. You can get 50% performance improvement within 1 week. It took 1 week, and this was actually merged already. Yeah. All right, now for the famous email contribution process. It's not that complicated. The most complicated step is to be able to send free format email somewhere. This is often a problem in bigger companies, and most companies that eventually gave up with Outlook and put some Linux mail server somewhere. I've seen this at Intel, it's the same at ARM. Just for the guys that need to send patches by email. But I think Gmail works pretty well, right, for this. So I found instructions how to set up Gmail for Gitsend email. So the email format is there for a reason. A lot of people complain about it, but it's a basic text format. That's Unix standard. So that means you have all kind of tools that can parse text that can work on top of that. It's well understood and robust system. It's a shared infrastructure. That's also very important, right? If you would 5 years ago say, oh, GitHub is great and we do everything on GitHub, and suddenly some big company buys the GitHub thing, then oops. And the same could happen to GitLab or whatever instance you come up with. And email has the nice feature of being really spread out and shared, and no one has to. I mean, you can set up your own archive if you like, right, by just subscribing. Also, there's a lot of tooling now these days from the Linux Foundation that goes on top, and that doesn't even require you to be subscribed or have the emails, because for instance, the emails are in what's called public inbox, which is a Git repository of emails. So every email is a patch, so to speak, in this Git repository. It's added. And so a tool can basically parse all the emails very efficiently and download them. Also, what I see a lot in emails is, oh, I'm not subscribed, please CC me. Yes, that's the default. No one relies on you. I mean, if we send an email, then people click reply all. That's the rule. So definitely you, as the sender of the email, you get the email. You get every reply back. And you don't need to mention that you're not subscribed. Many people are not subscribed to the specific mailing lists. Sometimes, so I'm subscribed to Linux ARM because that is kind of catch-all list, and a lot of patches get there. But I don't browse that list. I just use that sometimes if I need to look up something. If you're not subscribed, you can use law.kernel.org. That has a good old 1995 web interface, but it works pretty nicely and it's pretty fast, and the search is pretty nice. Or you use Google and just put some whatever you find in there, and most of the time it points to law. And the good thing is that if you look more closely in law, then you find that has a good feature. It knows about patch sets, it relates to them. You can jump from one patch to the parent patch or to sibling patches. You can see all the replies. And this has instructions how you can reply even though you are not subscribed. So there are ways where you can download the email, import them into your email client, and it looks like you have been receiving this email before. And then you can just hit reply in your email client and you get a proper reply, including all CCs and stuff. So that's a pretty neat feature. So if you find something, you can jump on an existing thread without having been subscribed before. For generating the patch email, use git format patch and git send email, just show this. That it's all described in detail in this file in the kernel. The nice thing is it explains all the things and it has rationale why those things are. So you don't just need to say, oh, that's stupid. It says you why it is this way. Also, one pro tip, always send stuff to yourself first. Because there are many things that can go wrong when you send email. One common thing is that you left previous patch emails in the folder and you use wildcards and send emails and suddenly all your old stuff gets long. Or you messed up any kind of address things. You see that if you send stuff to yourself. Also, it's good to read the email in a different, or to read the patch in a different environment than you wrote it. So write it in your editor. And eventually, if you see it in your email client, sometimes stuff looks more easy, or sometimes the spell checker of your email will tell you what you spelled wrong. So this is a kind of short cut off the command line stuff that you need to do. So you start with, you have all your patches lined up in Git. You start with git format patch, and it's the simplest way of calling this. So you say minus a number that tells you how many patches you want to generate. The last argument is where you start. So if the patches are really on top, then you just use head. But I sometimes have some debug patches on top, so then I set head tilde 2 or whatever. So skip the head, the top two patches, and then use the 5 below there. And minus minus cover letter generates you a cover letter template so that all falls into place. Then you run check patch on those patch files, and it tells you what is wrong. And it's typically some things you can ignore. Some maintainers are very picky. Some even require check patch minus minus strict because they don't really clean. It's a good time to fix those stuff. So it tells you about coding style problems first, but it's go far beyond that. So for instance, it already tells you if you submit a device tree patch where the binding has not been upstream before and stuff. So it has some really knowledge and goes in the code base. Or it tells you if you submit a driver that uses a compatible string which has not been described and stuff. So those things. If you change stuff, don't change them, please, in those patch files. It's easy, it's tempting, I understand. Change them in a repository because, yeah, you need that in your repository. It changed. Then you fill in the cover letter, like this. Typically takes me like half an hour or 1 hour to write a good cover letter, so it's not something that you should just paper over. I'd give you some more in a minute. Yeah, and then you send, as I said, you send it to yourself first. And then you see in your email client, oh, did I have the right number of patches? Is the cover letter right? Is there some obscure from line? Sometimes you see that the patch contains something, a rebase artifact or whatever, and it got wrong. So it's a good idea to just browse over this in your email client because it's a different way of presenting things and it helps to find bugs. And now the tricky part, who to send the patches to. So some people say, oh, the list, and then they send it to LKML and then wonder why nothing happens. So there's get maintainer poll. It's a script that reads a patch file and then figures out who's responsible for doing this. And it gives you a long list sometimes. What I do, I go over the list and then apply some reason to, sometimes it's very verbose and it tells you about, especially if there's no good, if the file is not mentioned explicitly, then it tries to figure out who contributed to the file. And then you get all the people that did white space changes in the last 2 years. They might not be interested in your patch anymore. So yeah, sometimes it's a bit tricky. I mean, you could always defend yourself and say, hey, that's what check patch told me. So if people complain, then they should fix check patch. And it's good to send, so there are sometimes it says maintainer or something very specific, or reviewer. I typically do those people in two, because they are the people that need to do something with your patches. Don't put a list in two. I mean, it's like, can someone help me? It's not a good question. Can you please help me? It's much better. So you want something from the maintainer, so that's why you put them in two and put the rest of the people in CC. If you know that people have a board, for instance, or have been talking about this in the past, it's good to CC them so they know about your patch and they can react. And if they get the email in your inbox, it's for them, it's much easier to say, great, it works, tested by something. And then eventually you send out the stuff and this typically gets a long list of minus minus two. So yeah. If you are below three lines, you're probably doing something wrong there. It must be. Yeah. Okay. I summarized that because there was some people on for the Awana stuff. I summarized them in the wiki. I give some more details on the stuff. If you can follow this link. Something about commit messages and cover letters. I find that many people don't really know what to write there. So they can make a pretty good subject line, but that's about it. And sometimes they copy the subject line again, and or just say, edit, do it, or whatever. And this is not a good commit message. So basically, so one thing is that you should, that's specifically more important for a cover letter, you should give some scope. What is it about? Imagine some random guy on a mailing list stumbles upon your email or your patch series, and those random guy could be Linus Torvalds or more likely Greg Cage, for instance, who kind of looks for stable patches and stuff. So he needs to know very quickly, because he's a busy guy, he needs to know very quickly what this is about. If this is about some stupid onboard, then yeah, he might not care and move on, which is good for you probably. But you want to give some idea, and you have to make sure that you explain it to someone who knows about Linux and who knows about computers, but might not know about your specific project. So it's not a good idea to start with a sentence that consists of 4 3-letter acronyms that make sense to you, but don't make sense to anyone else. So especially for cover letters for larger series, I often spell out what the thing is in the first occasion and then put the abbreviation in brackets so people can see, oh, this is what I mean. So for instance, there's a new ARM thing, PIE. It's an ARM architecture feature, an upcoming for indirection overlays, whatever. So PIE, people think, oh, it is position independent executable, but actually it's something else, right? So there's a lot of clash with those acronyms. So make sure that you explain that. So it's a good thing in the first sense to get some, this is about this ARM board and I changed the frequency or whatever. So then people in the first sense can see whether that is of interest for them or not. And then a good guideline is that I think that comes from GKH. He said, why should I take your patch, right? I mean, Linux is perfect, we all know it. And so why do you mess with my code base here? And this is, it sounds presumptuous, it probably is, but it's also, there's some truth in there, right? So, I mean, so far, Linux has been around for a while, and apparently works quite well. Why do you need to change it now? So you have to give some rationale. What is the problem? Why is the current code not enough? Why do you change that? And that typically gives you a good mindset of writing a commit message. So you say, so far, we've been assuming that all boards run below 1 gigahertz, whatever. Now, the new board supports 1.2 gigahertz, and this is an effect, and that's why we need to fix it. So then it becomes obvious, oh yeah, there's something that has worked before, now doesn't work anymore. It could be that because of your special setup, there's a bug that has never been exposed, but was always in there, and now it's exposed. That's also good to spell out, and people say, okay, yeah, I see. Also a good idea to take inspiration from previous patches to the same file. Especially that's good for the suffix for the prefixes that you need to put in the subject line. So you use git log, and then it shows you all the patches that have been touching that file in the past. And then you go over and then figure out, oh yeah, this is what people write. Also good general guideline for writing commit messages is that you start with describing the current situation, describing the problem with that, and then describing what you fix. You typically should say why you need that fix, so focus more on the why than on the what, because the what is already in the patch. So you see, oh yeah, you add this line. You don't need to say I add this line, because it's in the patch. Commit messages can be very long. That's not uncommon. So I've seen commit messages of 2 pages where people paste in kernel logs. And that is actually a good idea, because then Google can pick this up. And if you have a problem, you can basically look for the most specific error message. You Google for the specific error message. And if you're lucky, it finds you that patch because of the commit message. And Google knows that patches are good quality. Over other things, so that's why they typically bubble up then. So it's not uncommon to have a one-line patch and one-page commit message. And then eventually the cover letter. Some of the things I said for commits images apply to cover letters as well. It's more broader scope, and the cover letter can contain information that is only important momentarily. First, a general summary, just as I said, just to give scope that people understand what this is about. You can mention process-related issues. This relies on dispatch set. This goes on top of RC3 or whatever. And you can mention that there are still problems in there, which you promise to fix later. Probably never do, but anyway. Or would you test it, or there are some known problems and stuff. So this is good in there. One thing to keep in mind, the cover letter will be in an email archive, but will be not in Git, in the Git history. So whatever you put in there will be lost somewhat if you look at Git. So if you have something important that applies, that is to know, then either put it in a patch commit message or put it even better in a comment, so that it stays in the code or in the commit message. Right, okay. So to summarize, in general, don't rely on downstream projects. If something works with Ambient, that's great, but we need to work it in mainline. And it actually makes less work for Ambient people because they can remove that patch file from their things. Look at what's close to you, your board, your use case. Sometimes people use special setup that no one else has done before. That's good for you to test because you are the expert in this, right? So you can test that. Look for existing patches somewhere else, or look for merged patches for inspiration to see what other people do and copy that. Also, one thing which I always have to remind myself about, don't wait for perfection. There will never be perfect a patch, and there will be sometimes things are debatable. You can do two approaches, two things, and then you say, I should do it this way or this way, and then you think about it for 2 weeks, and then you forget about it, and the patch will never be set, right? So you will, the first version will never be merged anyway, and so what I think, okay, at some point you have to cut it off and say, okay, this is it, I tested it, it works, so I send it out, and then wait for feedback. And if people say what I already anticipated, great, then I can reply and have something. Or I know that it's what is the better idea. Maybe you have already an alternative patch or something. Yeah, but the main thing is just do it and don't wait. It's like in this Harry Potter movie in the third part, where he waits for his father to appear and send the Patronus thing, if you remember, in this time loop thing. But actually figures out, actually it's myself that sends the Patronus. So in this spirit, just do it. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Yeah.
Did you try before for sending patches? I have been meaning to try it out, but
no. I was hoping you would. No, I hear that people that are more involved in kernel maintaining, they rely on it these days, and apparently it works with U-boot as well, because they use somewhat compatible infrastructures. And a lot of people, I think if you have a larger volume of emails, or if you are a maintainer with more income, then it's pretty much essential these days to keep up the work, and it keeps work away from the maintainers. So it seems to be a good thing, but I haven't tried it personally.
You can send out patches to not just apply them. So it can do this Git maintainer.
It's very, very powerful, I hear. But. All right. Yeah, then thanks.
Thank you again.